Good afternoon. So last time we finished talking about HCL, we talked about how wires actually worked, about them having widths and number of bits they could hold. We talked about our built-in components, that what the representation was in our text-based programming language, of our register file and our memories. We talked about with pictures earlier. We mentioned sort of quality of life things, like how do I debug what's going on with my HCL program. We have outputs for that and doing stepping, which hopefully will make it possible when things go wrong to figure out what's happening without staring at your source code to figure it out. Then we went on a walkthrough of the various stages that our textbook talked about and looked systematically, like what do all the instructions do, and given that, where do we need to make a decision and therefore need a mux, and what are those values? We mentioned some things where the textbook made some particular decisions that you won't need to make, like the textbook decided I'm always going to send the result of the ALU to that E value input to the register file, rather than sometimes using that input for memory, or rather than having a way to shortcut the value from the immediate directly into the register file input. And this was a decision the textbook made that you don't have to do the same thing. So any questions about anything we talked about last time with our single cycle processor and building that type of processor in HCL? Okay, so we're going to move on from having a processor that works, which was our focus previously, was that we had one cycle per instruction, and otherwise we didn't care about performance really. We just said, I want a processor that does the right thing, this is how we build it. And this is the simplest way to build it, arguably. But we're going to start talking about making things faster. And to talk about that, we need to talk about, well, how fast is our current processor? And we know we do one instruction per cycle, but how long is a cycle? And to set the time of a cycle, we need enough time for what's known as the critical path. That every path from a state output, like from the PC register, its output, needs to be able to go through all the components, like through the instruction memory, through the register file, through the ALU, and so on, and come back to the inputs to all our state elements in time for the rising edge of the clock. So what's happening is we have our clock cycle, we have our rising edge. This is when our states change, state outputs change. Most notably the PC changes. And then we have, by this time, we need our need state inputs. And it's going to be the case that when we like send a value to our ALU, it's going to take some amount of time for its outputs to become stable so they're ready for those inputs, like to our PC, our register file, next value, and so on. And the way we determine how long we can make the clock cycle is we think about all the ways things can get from our outputs to our inputs, the inputs we need at the rising edge of the clock, and think of how much time does this take? How much time does it take for the ALU to process this input and produce its output? Go through each step for each path, and we take the slowest path. So let's look at what that might look like, say, on our sequential processor, and I'm going to make up some amounts of times. So one path we need to worry about is after we have our rising edge of the clock, the PC is producing a value. That value needs to get to this adder. The adder needs to take that into account and produce its output. It needs to go through this mux and be ready when that next rising edge of the clock happens for the PC to store it in the next cycle. And let's say we look up from whoever gave us our adder and find out that that takes like 20 picoseconds, and maybe this mux takes like 5, and we get some amount of time, like say 25 picoseconds. So we're going to just look on this path to figure out how long that takes. And we're going to do this. There's more paths we have to worry about. So another thing which needs to happen is we need to have a value get to the instruction memory. It needs to filter from the instruction memory through whatever this instruction length logic is. Then it has to go through the adder, take the amount of time that takes, then the mux. And we look up from whoever gave us our instruction memory, how much time does that need? Whoever gave us our instruction length circuit, how much time does that need? And from that, we figure out what's the amount of time this needs. In the same case, I'm saying that all sums up to, let's say, 50 picoseconds. And we repeat this for every single possible path we could think of. So we'll have some more interesting paths, like this one, where we go from the PC into the instruction memory, through the register file to read a register, through this mux here, then through the ALU, and then into the register file, and with enough time to set up storing that value. So we're ready at the rising edge of the clock. And maybe that takes 400 picoseconds when we add up the time that whoever gave us our ALU says it takes, and whoever gave us our register file says it takes, and so on. And we can do more possibilities. So we also have this path that goes through the register file, then the ALU, then through the data memory, and then through the register file, and we add up that time. And so we'll enumerate all sorts of these paths, and whichever one is longest, so probably this 900 picoseconds, that's going to be our cycle time. And our procedure is we're going to set in our processors, we're not going to be able to adjust the cycle time based on what's happening. You might say, gosh, most of our instructions don't use this red path here. They don't go through the data memory. Well, that's too bad. We're going to build our clock so it works with one amount of time. We're not going to be able to adjust it based on which instruction we're executing. Like, there are types of processor designs which work that way, but they're a lot more complicated. That's typically not what's done and not what we're going to do. So our procedure is we enumerate all these possible paths, and we know the longest one is going to determine our time, and the shorter ones, they fit in that time, so if we make a longer cycle time, they're still going to work. It's not a problem, but we're not going to be able to take advantage of them being faster. So it's not going to matter that this orange path is really short. We have to wait for the red path to finish in spite of that. So questions on these paths? So the longest path here is called our critical path, whatever determines our cycle time. And as I said, we want to actually enumerate all the paths. So for this circuit, it's actually really annoying. There's a lot of them. So I'll do this for our sequential ADQ circuit. So here I have my PC update path. So this needs to happen. Then we have, let's say, our path to set the destination register number. That needs to happen. We have our path to read register A and add it. We have our path and store the result. We have our path to read register B and add it and store the result. So those are all our possible paths. And so what I would do to figure out the cycle time is I enumerate all of these and take the longest one. And to know how long each one is, I need to be told by whoever made each component how long it takes. Yes?
Do those paths include a margin of error, or is that something we have to add on?
So the question is, do these include a margin of error? My assumption is that part of being told how long it takes by whoever made my register file, my instruction memories, they're going to include that in there. And also, we might need to account for the lengths of the connections between components, maybe as part of this. Okay, so that's figuring out how long these sorts of circuits take. So I'm going to talk about making my processors faster, but first I'm going to talk about making some other task efficient, and that's going to be talking about laundry. So here's a way I can do laundry. So I start my laundry at 11. I have two loads to do. So first I put my light colored clothes in the washer, wait for it to finish, move it to the dryer, wait for that to finish, fold all of that, put it away. Then I switch to my darker and colored clothes and put that in the washer, wait for that to finish, move back to the dryer, wait for that to finish, and then fold all of that, put it away. And, you know, after 3 hours, I've done two loads of laundry. So, anyone have any way I could maybe do this a little faster? Yeah.
I'm assuming the washer and dryer are the same device, so that's a thing. While books say the whites and dryer,
yeah, so I could. Yeah, so the observation is, gosh, the washer's not used during this time. Probably I should be using it. Yeah, so our fix is we can start our colors immediately, and then I even have time for another load of laundry if I want to. And the idea is we just, you know, we don't let our washer sit doing nothing and our dryer sit doing nothing. If we have something for it to do, we just pass that right off. And there's going to be a similar thing we can think about with our processor and its paths, is that, well, what we're doing is we're going through the instruction memory, then through the register file. So for most of our cycle, the instruction memory isn't doing anything. It's the same problem that the washer has. And we're going to apply this technique later on, but first I'm going to talk about sort of how well this works with our laundry scenario. We're going to have the same sorts of trade-offs. But the idea is, just like our instruction memory acts near the beginning of our cycle, the washer, in my first case, only does anything at the beginning of doing a load, and then I'm not using it when I could start my next load, or in the case of our processor, my next instruction right away. Something to note about this is that this isn't like quite using the washer all the time. We aren't getting 100% efficiency as far as if you think about how much am I using the washer or the folding table. We have this wasted time. And actually, this picture is kind of unrealistic. It would suggest I have a really fast dryer, which maybe I could have, but that's not very common. So probably my picture looks something more like this. I have all this time during which I can't actually use my, you know, I have my washer, you know, not being used because I'm waiting for the dryer. Yes?
I also don't think I've ever met anyone who takes half an hour to fold their laundry.
Yes, yeah, so this might also be unrealistic, yes. Note that this is wide enough so I can fit the name. Cheers. Part of the choice. So we have this extra wasted time because it turns out that our dryer is a little slower and we have to wait for it because we only have one dryer. So we're going to be concerned with two different ways of measuring the efficiency here. And I note that if you were asking me, I'd like you to do this load of laundry as fast as possible, I have not done that. I am not doing loads of laundry as fast as possible if we're thinking about how much time did it take you to do that load of laundry. Because the time it took me to do this load of laundry is 2.1 hours. Which is longer than if I was just doing it the way I was originally doing it, where I was doing one at a time. So this is known as the latency, the time from when we start something to when we finish it. And the latency got worse. But I'm okay with that because the latency isn't actually what I care about. I don't want to say, I want to do each load of laundry as fast as possible. That's not what I care about. I want to do all my loads of laundry as fast as possible collectively. And the same thing is going to be true when we talk about processors. The question is, I want to execute this add instruction as fast as possible. That's not what we're going to try to do. I want to execute this program with millions of instructions to run as fast as possible. So we don't care about this number. But this is called the latency. So it's how long from start to finish. And by doing this, what we'll call pipelining, by feeding thing from one step to the next when the component's available, I've made it slower than everybody's doing one thing at a time. But what I really care about is what we call throughput. The amount of time between when I finish each load of laundry, or alternately, this is the same thing as the amount of time between when I start each load of laundry. And we'll typically measure this in operations per unit time, so in this case, loads per hour. So I'm doing finished in 1.2 loads of laundry per hour. And we can measure this by looking at how often I finish things or how often I start things, because I can't start something until I finish the next thing, because I'm waiting for the next thing in line, and the last thing is waiting for the previous thing to finish, and so on. Everything depends on the rate of the slowest part of this, which is the dryer. That determines how long between when I finish things. So in this case is 1.2 loads an hour. For a processor, we'll talk about instructions per like nanosecond or something like that. But this is what we're measuring that we care about. It's not the amount of time it takes me to do each load. I can't do a load of laundry in less than an hour, because washer plus dryer takes more time than that. But I can finish a new load every more than once an hour. And that's what I really care about, because typically I'm not doing just one load of laundry, but at least two or three. And when we think about a processor, typically we're not executing one instruction, we're executing millions. So we really care about this number over our latency. So questions about latency and throughput? Also note, when I'm talking about throughput, generally I'm going to assume that we're not in the starting up state. So like notice here, I'm assuming we have like work to do to keep the dryer full. Generally we are going to ignore the starting up state, like right here where we don't have any waiting. We're just going to ignore that, because in our processor, if we're executing a million instructions, there's no way we could take advantage of that anyways. And it's not really worth trying. Okay, so I talked about this idea, which we call pipelining, in the sort of assembly line fashion, use one component, then the next. I want to apply it to this very bad way of multiplying a value times 3. So here I'm adding a value to itself, getting at 2 times the value, then adding that to the original value to get 3 times the value. And if we think about how this runs, we have the same problem I had with my washer here, that I input 7, then the adder takes some amount of time. We're going to say each adder takes 50 picoseconds from when its inputs are available to when it can have an output that's ready. So during the first 50 picoseconds, this first adder is working, and then it doesn't have anything to do. And then during the second 50 picoseconds, the second adder is working, and then finally we have our answer. And if I want to multiply a whole lot of numbers by 3, I would like to start multiplying the next number by 3 right here. That's where our benefit's going to be, because I have all this unused time before I would start my next multiply. So, you know, right now, when we're starting out, I have 100 picoseconds of latency. It's my time per computation, so my throughput is 10 results per nanosecond. And my hope is that I can improve this throughput to basically around 20 by starting the next operation right away, even though I won't improve my latency. So basically, this is the timetable I'm going to start with. I compute a new value every 100 picoseconds. And this is the timetable I want to end up with, that I start a value, basically around every 50 picoseconds, and step them through. So we're using this first adder all the time, the second adder all the time, rather than only using it half the time. Like in our original picture, we have this idle time. So you might say, well, it seems like we should just, you know, every around 50 picoseconds change the value on this wire and, you know, use that to work. There's two problems with that. So one problem is that if we change the value from 7 to 17 here, then we have the wrong value on this. Another problem is if we change the value from 7 to 17 here, then this 14 starts changing. And it needs to stay the same so the second adder can work. So our solution to that is that after we compute this first value, this 14, we're going to save the value 14 somewhere. We need to save it so we can work on it with the second adder while the first adder is doing something else. And this is something which like comes up in my laundry case, that I can't actually start my next load in the washer immediately. I need to move the clothes. You know, I need to have them somewhere else. And here we need to have explicitly, you know, store values in between. Another way of thinking about this is that during this time, I said that the first adder is not doing anything, but that's not true. The first adder is storing the value 14. Just storing it for us so we can have it as input. So we're going to want to something else to store the value 14. And similarly, down here, we have the value 7, which is being like kept on this wire. But since we want a different value here versus here, we're going to need to store that value 7 somewhere. So my solution is I need something that can store a value. And we've talked about a way of doing that, and that's a register. So we're going to add registers. And basically what we're going to do is we're going to say, I want to split the circuit into two halves. And everything that crosses that line that separates the two halves, I'm going to put a register on. So I end up with this. I'm also, in order to make sure I feed values with the right timing, I'm adding registers to both ends. So something to note about notation here is I'm saying, this is t plus 0, so this is at time 0. We have the value that was inserted at time 0 ends up here. So we have the older value here, and we have the newer value here. And as values become older, they move from left to right. So that means that we'll have 3 times a for the value that was inserted at time 0, while the value that was inserted time A will be here, and 2 times it that will be here, and the value that was inserted at time 2 will be sitting here, being multiplied by 2. And so our timeline might look something like this, that we insert 7 initially here, and we compute as we're doing that, so we have 7 sitting on the output of this, and therefore we have 14 here and 7 here. And that means that during the next rising edge of the clock, that we're going to move this 14 over to here and this 7 over to here. And at the same time, we're going to take whatever value was being input here, which looks like was 17, and that's going to move over. So then during the next time, we're going to end up with 17 here, 14 here, and 7 here. This 14 plus 7 is going to go through this adder. We're going to get 21 sitting here, which is going to shift over to the other side eventually. And we're going to have 17 plus 17, 17 sitting here, and 17 plus 17 is 34 sitting here. Then during the next step, after the next rising edge of the clock, we're going to copy this 34 over, and this 17 over, and this 21 over, and we're going to have 34 sitting here, and 17 sitting here. We're going to add 34 and 17 to get 51. While we have 21 on our output here, which is what shown at the bottom of the timeline. And all this happens based on a clock signal. So the clock signal, we have a rising edge of the clock that starts this cycle where we start computing. Then we have another rising edge that switches our value over to 17, and so on. So questions? Yeah. The question is, does adding the registers increase the latency? And the answer is yes, and we'll talk about why next. Other questions? So the general pattern we see is that values move from left to right. So the next thing that was inserted is behind the value, like following behind as things move from left to right. And we have these rising edges of the clock, everything in lockstep moves to the next thing over, and we get something new coming in. And you're mentioning about latency. So this picture implies that I instantly go from 7 to 17. And that's unfortunately not something that registers can actually do. That it's not instantaneous. So if we zoom in on this transition period where the register is taking this input and starting to output it, that we have some tolerances we need to worry about. There's some amount of time before that rising edge of the clock where the input can't change, or else the register might be confused about what the value is. That it can't read the value instantaneously, it actually reads it over a small period of time. It needs not to be changing during that time. There's also some amount of time here where we were outputting blue and we need to change to outputting green, and that can't be done instantaneously, so there's some amount of time during which the register's output will be changing shortly after that rising edge. So we'll call the sum of these two times the register delay. And to know what that is, we'll have to be told by whoever made our registers. But it's not going to be zero. This is going to take some physical amount of time. And this is going to mean, even in a case like this, where we split up our computation imperfectly into two pieces, because of the registers, it's going to take some extra time as far as latency is concerned. Yeah?
So we have to worry about this in HTLRS.
The question is, will we have to worry about this in HTLRS? The answer is no, because HTLRS doesn't deal with timing. Like, we never set what the cycle time is, so like it's always long enough. Okay. So if we think about the timing then, let's say our adders, like before, take 50 picoseconds. Let's say we have a 10 picosecond register delay. In that case, we can see that we have, you know, a bunch of 30 extra picoseconds for the values to filter through this picture. Now that we have these extra registers, notably including this 10 picoseconds in the middle. So how about the throughput? What's the throughput? So with throughput, we're concerned about, the question is, what is the time between when things either start or finish? So we want to know what's the time between here and here when two things start, or the time between here and whenever the next thing finishes, when we have 51 here. So you're saying 60 picoseconds is that time. And your notion for that is, well, we have to go through, we have to get the output of a register and go through the middle and then have the input of the next register. So we have to pay for the register delay. So here I've drawn it as we pay for the register delay and then we do the add. We could also have drawn this as we pay for half of the input register delay and half of the output and get the same number. It's equivalent. It's easier to draw it this way is why I did it. But you can also say 5 picoseconds for the first register and 5 for the end. So our throughput is 1 over 60 picoseconds, or about 16 billion operations a second. So because of our 10 picosecond register delay, we didn't end up running things twice as fast, which would be 20 billion operations a second. We ended up being 1.6 times as fast. So any questions on this? So this is our throughput. So not only is our latency worse, but because of this register delay, our throughput is also worse. Because now we actually have to take some time that we don't parallelize to, our throughput is worse than we would expect because we have to take some time that we didn't actually manage to do in parallel to save values in between. And this is something which would have happened if I was thinking carefully about the laundry example, is that I need to move stuff, that takes time. There's the cost there, I wasn't drawing on my picture at all. Okay, so to do this, so I got 1.6 times faster by splitting up my multiply by 3 into two roughly equal pieces. So why? Let's do some more. Let's just say, you know, I drew a line in the middle. Why don't I draw two more lines? They happen to pass through some adders, but I mean, there must be something there. So I'll just put a register with whatever values are in the middle. And that's how it'll work. So we'll have our, you know, partial results and values. And, you know, let's say I split things up. So now I have 25 picoseconds for the first half of the ad, then some registers, then 25 picoseconds for the second half of the ad, and so on. So first of all, what's my throughput now? What should it be? How many operations per second do I get to do now? I need multiplying times 3. How many picoseconds? About a trillion. I don't need an exact answer. I won't. Okay. If you can give it to me unsimplified, that's fine. Like 1 over x picoseconds.
Okay, 1 over 35.
1 over 35. So how did you get 35?
25 for the operation, 10 for register validation.
Yeah, so we take any of the operations, like, and a register delay along with it, because we need to like store and its result and send it to the next cycle. So I drew a different line, which is equivalent. So we get is around 28 billion operations a second. And that's our time. So note that by splitting things up into four pieces, I ended up with something which was less than 3 times faster. And this is the general thing we'll see, is that because we have these extra costs to dividing things up, these register delays to store the values to pass between the steps, that we end up with some inefficiency versus sort of our ideals. We think doing four things at once means that we're going to do 4 times as much. We actually end up doing a little less than 3 times as much. And this gets worse and worse as we divide things up more. Yes?
Will we always get one result each cycle when we create a pipeline?
The question is, will we always get one reality cycle? With designs like this, yes. We will talk about reasons why that might not happen with our processor later on. But for now, like, all our designs are going to be one result per cycle. Okay. And so we have this diminishing returns as we add these pipeline stages that we still get, you know, with this design, we still get one result every cycle. But the issue is our cycle time doesn't decrease that fast. We have a limit that, well, you know, even if we can split up the logic into 1 picosecond pieces, which you might say, that doesn't seem possible. It seems like we probably can't do that. Then we have this 11 picosecond cycle because of these register delays. And this means that we have diminishing returns, that our first split gave us almost half cycle time, but it gets worse and worse as we go on. Yes?
Could you please explain that again? What's the partial results thing?
So what's the partial results thing? So the assumption is that, well, the adder is doing something. I can just figure out whatever wires have values halfway in between. I'm going to just store those in a register. And it's a good question of whether this is possible. And the answer is not always. And we'll talk about the consequences of that later.
Wait, so if you're doing
Yeah, so the idea is the add computes some intermediate results. You could imagine maybe it's the result without carrying being handled yet, or something like that. Why would you store that? So you can do the first part of the add in parallel at the same time as you do the second part of a different add. So the idea would be that we could hopefully be computing, we can be computing the first part of 7 plus 7 here while we're computing like 14 plus 14 here. And like there's some intermediate result, you know, that would let us, you know, we could store in between to let us do that with this one adder. But it's a good question, like what does that actually, what do the partial results actually look like? And I didn't specify because it's actually going to be problematic. Okay, so other questions? Yeah, so, but an example, like the intuition for an add is it might be like we compute the carries and the results before carrying is handled as their partial result, and the second half is handling that, might be the sort of thing that would happen. Okay. So, however, even when we can split things up like that, we end up that, you know, the splitting doesn't help that much. And if we think about the time, this is the time per completion, so the time for each cycle, that it gets lower and lower, but we're limited by the register delay. We have to pay for the register delay every cycle. So no matter how small of a piece we can divide the add into, if we can like do each bit separately or whatever, we still have to pay for this register delay. So even when we split things up perfectly, we end up that we get, you know, we get almost the full speed up for adding the first piece division, but when we're going from say 14 to 15, we're getting 2% better for our extra stage. No. So maybe it's not worth it. Another way of looking at this is with the throughput, that we get almost twice the throughput when we add our first stage, but when we add in more and more pieces, we got this little bit of benefit. And this is asymptotic. We're approaching our 100 operations per nanosecond, which is our maximum rate of register updates. Where that would be what we'd have if all we needed to do was send a value from one register to another. Okay. But the question about like what are these partial results that let us do this? How do we store the important part of 7 plus 7 so we can just start computing a new value? It gets to the question of like, is this possible? And the answer is, well, sometimes there's a natural way to split up something like an add, where we can like find carries or so on. But often there either isn't, or maybe there's a way of splitting it up, but it doesn't end up being even. Like, we can divide it up into two pieces, but maybe the last piece is simpler than the first piece. The first piece is like computing without the carries, second piece is computing the carry, dealing with the carry bits. And that might be a lot shorter. Okay, so let's say we couldn't split that second add evenly. What's our throughput if we do this? This still works, but what's our throughput going to be? Remember our procedure for figuring out what's our cycle time is we look for the critical path, the longest path from state to state. All our registers are state. Yes?
1 over 40.
So 1 over 40. So our notion is that we have that the critical path that matters is going to be the one that goes from here through to this register, or from here through to this register. And this these both take 40 picoseconds. And yes, we have some other paths. So for example, we have also this path here, which takes 30, if we include the register it goes to. And we have this path here, which takes 35, if we include one of the registers, and so on. But it's the longest one which matters, our critical path. So that's our longest stage, which is this 40 picosecond one. So that's about 25 billion operations per second. So this is another thing which is going to get worse and worse when we try to split things up more and more, that will not have ways to approximately evenly divide things. And it can be even worse than this picture suggests. So here, I divided up my adder into a 30 picosecond piece and a 20 picosecond piece, but at least the sum was 50. Maybe we can't do that because maybe, you know, we have our pieces look like, we think of our timeline, we have one piece which feeds into the next piece, and we have another thing that happens at the same time that takes longer. We split this up into something like one piece and the other thing that takes longer, and then after the clock cycle, the next piece. You know, so we manage to not get even, you know, manage to take even longer. So we'll end up where we like split up our 100 picoseconds of logic into a 60 picosecond chunk and a 45, where there was previously some overlap, that let that be 100 that we got rid of. It's still a lot better, but this is not nearly our ideal of nearly twice as fast, because we both have the register delay and the cost that we can't actually find a dividing point that makes everything be evenly split up. And you know, it's going to be worse and worse as we go to smaller and smaller pieces. And this means that, you know, we're not going to asymptotically approach that register delay. It's, you know, there's eventually going to be a point where this doesn't really help us. Okay. So, any questions on sort of splitting? Okay, so these diminishing returns that we have from adding more stages mean that there's going to be a small number of stages which we're going to want to add, and typically we're not going to want to try to divide things into lots of little pieces because, you know, we're typically going to have real trouble doing that. That the reason you won't see someone trying to do this is not only because, you know, this 30 picosecond split doesn't work, but because even doing a splitting like this is really hard because of the, you know, adders don't really work that way. Like, we could maybe figure out ways of approximating that if we knew about how adders worked, but that's often going to be very difficult. So we'll typically have a smaller number of stages. And it's a big question of, like, what things do you divide things into? And our textbook has a particular choice. And you might have figured out that, well, we talked about stages. Those stages are actually for this pipelining idea. So we're going to take the stages we talked about that were previously just these conceptual things, where the stages didn't actually say when things happen. We had this writing, which all happened at the end of the cycle. And we had these reading, which just happened not necessarily immediately afterwards, but just when values were available. So probably in order, but only because we had to wait for the input to be stable, which just happened naturally, you know, after you read the instruction. It was the only time you could read the registers. But we're going to turn this into real stages where we know they're going to happen one at a time because we're going to save the values in pipeline registers, these registers in between the stages, before we pass them to the next one. So we're actually going to enforce that we have one stage at a time. But when we do that, we're going to make a little bit of a change to these stages. So our textbook stages for the pipelining change the first stage. So our first stage is going to be fetch and PC update, giving us only five stages. Yes?
If we go back just like a little bit, so like, how can you like read the data memory before, like you have to read the instruction memory before the data memory?
So I agree that yes, we read the instruction, the metadata memory after we read the instruction memory and after we read the register file. But that's a consequence of the dependencies in the circuit, not because all the paths that go to the data memory go through, not because we've set up these stages. So for example, let's say we added an instruction that was like was equivalent to a move constant into constant address into a register. Like that instruction might happen, do the read from the data memory before the execute, right? Because there's no execute. Like not in our processor, doesn't have an instruction like that, so it won't happen, but the stages don't actually enforce what happens in what order. It's just because of the dependencies that it works out that way for the reads. Yeah.
Can we go back to the next slide?
Yeah.
Okay, so if we combine fetch and PC update, and then we call, for example, ret, we can't update the PC.
So yeah, so someone notices, so I'm saying we compute the next PC right away, and I'm saying now we're really doing things in this order, and for most instructions this works, but ret is a problem, conditional jumps are a problem, because we don't have the information available yet to do it. For conditional jumps, we need to know about the condition codes, and if we remember when we talked about our textbook's design, they're in the execute stage where the condition codes are, not available yet. For return, we need to read the memory, it's not available yet. And this is indeed a big problem, a problem we will discuss solutions to later. For today, we're going to just happily ignore the problem, and we're just gonna say, we can compute the PC during the fetch stage. And that's really useful, because what we want to do is during the first, we want to fetch an instruction, you know, A, and we want to use that so we can fetch B while we decode A at time 2. So we want to start fetching the next instruction right away after we finished the fetch stage of the first instruction. And that means we need to know what the PC is for the next instruction right away. And that's why we combine things like this. But as you observe, this works sometimes, but not always. So we're going to have some solutions for the cases where it doesn't work, which are going to have some cost. And we'll talk about those after the exam. But the reason we're combining them is because if we didn't, if we kept PC update at the end, then we can't actually start fetching something right away after we finish fetching the first thing. And that would kind of defeat the whole point of pipelining. We'd end up looking like my original laundry flowchart of doing one thing at a time. And we'd end up with a processor that was slower than our single cycle processor, which is not what we want. So let's think about how this works out with our add processor. So here I have my add, and I'm going to highlight the stages. So we have our combined fetch and PC update. So it's all together, so I don't have that split up. Then I have my decode, which remember is just reading register, so I've highlighted the top of the register file. My write back, which is just writing register, so I've highlighted the bottom. And my execute, since this only executes adds, we're going to omit the memory stage, so it's not there. So we want to set store values in pipeline registers, these registers that separate these stages, in order to pass them from one to another. But before that, we have a bit of a problem. That if I just draw lines separating the stages, I have a line that separates a value coming from fetch to write back. And that's going to take the instruction that's currently being fetched and the instruction that's currently executing, and we're going to combine those two values together if I just draw lines and put registers across everything which crosses those lines. And the problem is,
registers on that wire.
So you could say we could have three registers on the wire. That is a solution. I'm going to do it in a slightly different way. So our problem is that the signal skips two stages. That to do this pipelining, we want to have things go from one stage to the next to the next. And the way I'm going to solve this is I'm going to redraw this signal so it doesn't do that. So it's the same wire. I just drew it so it went through every single stage, one after the other. So we never went from, so everything that comes from fetch goes to decode. And everything that comes from decode goes to execute. Everything that comes from execute goes to write back. We don't have any exceptions. And this way, things go from one stage to the next. No shortcuts. Yes?
Does that physically actually do anything, or is that purely conceptual?
So this is purely conceptual. Where it's going to do something is when I do what I said I would do before of everywhere I've drawn a line, I'm going to add registers.
Okay.
So now I'm going to add different registers, which is going to have the same effect as the suggestion of putting three pipeline registers on it, but in, I think, a slightly clearer way. So I'm going to add registers everywhere I drew a line. So there are my registers. And now we have a set of registers between fetch and decode, a set between decode and execute, and a set between execute and write back. That we have these sets of registers explains why HCL has register banks. They're precisely to help you handle these sets of registers. And this gives me my pipeline processor that only executes ads. So I'm going to want to often talk about what these registers are. So I'm going to call them by the names of the two stages they connect. So I'll call the first set of registers the fetch decode registers, the next set the decode execute registers, and the last set the execute write back. And as a sort of special case, we can think of the PC register as connecting the fetch stage to the next fetch stage, just like the decode to execute connects the decode stage to the next execute. RPC is like fetch to fetch. Yes.
How can we connect that to what we were talking about earlier, where there are three ads? Would that all be in the same execute stage?
The question: how would we connect this to where there were three ads? So we can think of that when we had three ads at a time, we had different parts of the ads. We had the first part of the ad of three multiplies, rather. We had first part of the ad, second part of the ad, and here we have our first part of the instruction, second part of the instruction, third part of the instruction, all at once.
But if you want to fit three ads in there, would you put them all in the execute?
So the question is, if I want to fit three ads, well, I can only have one ad at a time in this design.
Because of Y86.
Yeah. Well, because this is for Y86 add instructions, so I can only have one doing the add at a time with this design, but I can have different adds doing one add reading from the registers while the other is actually adding. And that's where I'm going to get my performance benefit. You could imagine that if we wanted to try to make this faster, we could try to support more than one add at a time by adding more stages or something like that, more than one actual execution of an ad, but that's not something we're doing. We're just following the textbook's idea that the execute stage is where the actual addition happens, and there's one execute stage running at a time. So let's think about how the execution of this looks like. So let's say we're executing this simple program here, add our 8, our 9, add our 10, our 11. So initially, our PC will be outputting the address of instruction 1. And that means that we'll have on here, we'll have 8 and 9. And we'll compute as input to the PC the address of instruction 2. That's our initial setup. So then we'll have a rising edge of the clock. And that means that this 8 is going to advance over here, and this 9 is going to advance over here. And at the same time, this address of 2 is going to advance over here. And that means that we'll have move on to having now we have the address of 2, we have the address of whatever 3 would be sitting on the input to the PC, while we have 8 and 9, which I remember from 1, sitting out the register, and therefore we have 9 sitting on there, and the value of 8 of R8 sitting here in R9. Yeah.
So what if, not in this machine, but in our machine pipeline with all the stages, one instruction reads from a register, one instruction writes to a register, and then the next instruction reads from that register, but the write hasn't gotten into effect yet, because it's still in the middle of the pipeline to do that.
So the question is, you're noticing that, gosh, we just read from a register without checking if someone is trying to write to it?
Yeah.
Something weird could happen, and the answer is yes. So this is another issue that we're gonna have to deal with, and for now we're gonna gloss over it, but we're definitely gonna have to deal with it really soon, because there's not many programs that will work correctly if we don't. Yeah. Questions are 10 and 11 the next things? Yes. So 10 and 11 are going to be sitting on the inputs to those registers, and that means when we advance to the next cycle, we're going to copy 10 over here and 11 over here. We're going to have the value of R8 here, and so on, which I believe I have as the next slide here. So we have the next cycle, we have 10 sitting here, 11 sitting here. We have the value of R8 here. The input to the corresponding register is the value of R10. And that means that, and while we're inputting R10 there, we're adding R8 and R9, which means that this is going to be the value of R8 plus R9, and the register number 9 that we want to write to next. And then during the next cycle, this value is going to advance over here, so we'll actually do the write. And the value of R10 is going to advance over to the other side there, and we'll start adding R10 and R11. Yes?
Let's say we hit a halt instruction.
So the question is, let's say we hit a halt instruction.
Send these halts all the way to the pipeline. We've written over some of our registers with the random memory that follows the halt instruction, because we're still reading and processing.
So your question is, how do we deal with the halt instruction in this? So notably, this processor is not even trying to implement a halt instruction, because we don't do anything with the opcode. And yes, we'll have to talk about how we handle a halt instruction later. That's another thing we're going to have to deal with. The question is, would it not go through the whole pipeline? So something we need to think about is, in order to finish an instruction, like the instruction, so that if we have, a halt instruction, it needs to go through all these stages. And that means that if we have an instruction, the instruction before the halt that we want to finish, we need to make sure it gets to the write back stage. So we're going to at least need to do that.
But so like as we're sending the halt instruction through the stages, we're reading in more instructions.
The question is, yeah, as we're
their random memory.
Okay, so the question is, when we're reading in the halt instruction, so if we have some extra instructions that we aren't meant to run, what's going to happen? So like instructions after a halt, and well, when do we actually change in this processor, when do we actually change the values in registers? What stage? So we have four stages: fetch, decode, execute, write back. Which stage changes values in registers?
Write back.
So as long as no instruction gets to write back, it doesn't do anything. So the question is, what about the data memory? We happily do not have that here, but when we do, we'll have to talk about how we deal with the problem you described. But for now, if it doesn't get to write back on this processor, it's 100% okay. Okay, so let's talk about the processor. Like, another way of looking at this is this sort of more systematic way, that here I'm printing out the values during each cycle that's being output by a register. So initially, during cycle, I call cycle zero, RPC is outputting zero. And during this time, we're inputting two into the PC register from our add two here. And we're also reading from the instruction memory and inputting 8 and 9 into our fetch to decode register. So during cycle 1, PC becomes 2, fetches our A, fetch to decodes RA becomes 8, fetch to decodes RB becomes 9. Then during the next cycle, we take this 8 and 9, use them to read the register file, to read 800 and 900 in this case. And so into these two pipeline registers, they're having 800 and 900 being input. So during the next cycle, that's the values they'll output. We also have register number 9 copied over as the input to this register here, so it will be output during the next cycle. Then during the following cycle, we have 800 and 900 sitting on the inputs to this add, being output from these pipeline registers. So we produce 1700, and we also pass through our register number 9. So we have 1,709 sitting as the inputs here. So during the next cycle, they'll output 1,700 as the value to write and 9 as the register to write it to. And so you can see that we can look at where the instruction is by stepping through the values in the pipeline registers. And something worth noting is that these registers that separate our pipeline stages contain all the relevant information about the instruction. That we can figure out what the instruction is from the data that we're keeping around. So initially we just have the PC, which, you know, before the fetch stage, that's all we use to figure out what the instruction is. After that, we don't want to look at the instruction memory again, so we figure out what the instruction is for our add-only processor with the two registers that are involved. Then we do our decode stage, and we never want to read the registers again, so we need to remember what the values we read are. So we have 800 and 900, and also the register we're writing to, that's all the information we need to do the rest of the instruction. So then we do our execute, where we do our add, and the information we have left over is the value we produced and where to write it. That's because the only step left is writing the value, so we have the information needed to do that, and that's in our registers. So each instruction passes through these steps, and that means that when we get, in this case, to our cycle 3, we have an instruction in address 6 being fetched, while we have R12 and R13 being decoded, while we have 1000 and 1100 being added together, and the register number 11 passed into the write-back stage, and we are writing 1700 to register 9. Yes?
Are we actually doing the writing
So the question is, are we actually doing the writing at 1700 at cycle 3? So, like we described earlier, the way our register file is going to work is that the write will actually take effect here and will prepare its input sometime around here. The reason why we do it as a separate stage is that our register file is probably going to need some time, more than a typical pipeline register, to process the inputs to set up the write to happen at that rising edge of the clock. So we need to, like, rather than, so like for the pipeline registers, like with a 10 picosecond delay, we said probably around 5 picoseconds to before the rising edge of the clock we need the input. The register file is probably a lot slower than that. And the write-back stage is to accommodate for that time. So the write will happen at this rising edge here, but we need to have the values ready like somewhere around here.
Like at cycle 4 is when R9.
Yes. So only after cycle 4, this is when R9 now equals 1700. Yeah. Yes.
So what if instead of there being two zeros, we just add QRA R9 and the next step over was add QR9 R8.
So question is, what if I try to write to register 9 or read from register 9 before I wrote it, And the answer is, this processor executes that program incorrectly. And we're going to talk about fixing that probably after the exam. But we're going to have to do some extra work to fix it that's going to make our processor a bunch more complicated. The simplest solution, and a real solution that some processors have used for this problem, is to say, don't write that program. That you as an assembly writer are responsible for not reading from R9 shortly after you wrote it. That's obviously not a very nice solution, so we'll have some better ones. Okay, so we have our simple ADDQ processor, which, as people have recognized, doesn't deal with some little problems that we might expect it to handle. But let's talk about its performance for the programs it can run correctly. And to know this, we need to think about our critical path. And what we'll think, usually our model will be that whoever gave us the components we used to build the processor tells us how long those components take. So here, I'm told this add2 takes 80 picoseconds, this instruction memory takes 200, this register file takes 125 for the read and 125 for the write, and we also have 100 picoseconds for the add. And to figure out how long things take, I look at my critical paths. So we didn't have our pipeline registers. We have our critical path. Our longest path is the one that goes from the PC through the instruction memory, through the register file, through the adder, back through the register file. So it does everything but the add2. Yes, we have to add2 every cycle, but that happens at the same time as we're accessing the instruction memory, so it's not a problem for our critical path for a single cycle version of this without the pipeline registers. And so that gives us one instruction every 550 picoseconds. With pipelining, we have to worry about the paths from register to register as what we're worried about. Now, from state to state, so I have my PC to these registers, so I have the instruction memory plus the register delay. Here, I have a path from here up to here, so that's the register delay, and I have a path from here through the register file, that's the register read plus the register delay. I have my path from here through the adder, which is the register delay plus the time for the add. And I have this path, which is just the register delay. And I have my path from here into the register file, which is possibly register delay plus the register file write. And the worst case here is the instruction memory. We have 200 picoseconds for that. Plus, we need the register delay getting the value from the PC and putting it in there. So it's about 200, a little more than 200 picoseconds for every pipeline stage to run. And remember, we can only set one cycle time, and it's the slowest stage. So that's going to be our performance, that we're going to run one instruction every 200 picoseconds. which notably is not even close to, four times as fast as our original. So four times as fast as our original would be like a little more than 100. Here we're like a little more than twice as fast for dividing things up into four pieces. And that's because, well, we had this register delay, which is probably going to be like 10-ish picoseconds maybe, and we had this uneven division, that our add was 100 picoseconds versus our instruction memory was 200. And that 200 determined how slow things were, and we didn't divide things up evenly. Also note that our latency is a lot higher. Our latency is 800 picoseconds plus four register delays. Because that's from starting an instruction to finishing it, so it's a lot longer to run each instruction. We have a huge extra cost, but we don't care probably, because if we think about a typical program, we're executing so many instructions, we really care about this instructions per time number, not the time each instruction takes from beginning to end, because they're overlapping with each other. So any questions about this computation? Yes?
Do we not consider the PC register delay when there is no pipeline?
So the question is, why didn't I include the PC register delay when there is no pipelining? And this is a something that maybe I should have done. So it's a tricky issue because we have the outgoing part of the PC register delay, but our slowest critical path doesn't include the incoming part. So really, to figure that out, we want to know about which side of the register delay, like how did it compare versus the register file writes. But yes, that is a good question about like where are we need to count for that somehow. Okay. Yeah.
Do you have to account for a register delay whenever you're writing to a register?
The question is, do we have to account for a register delay whenever we're writing to a register? Yes. It's gonna affect the critical paths. So notably, like for this pipelining case, the only thing which mattered was this path. So the amount of time needed to read the PC and write this is what mattered. So for example, if let's say our registers had different register delays, we wouldn't care about the different register delay here as long as our instruction memory was still our slowest path after taking that into account. Because the value would be ready in time with that cycle time we'd set for the instruction memory. But yes, we generally will need to account for writing a register because it's going to be part of our critical path. Yeah.
Well, like, why is it taking into account the PC register delay when like that's probably going to be happening like during the first few picoseconds of the 550? So wouldn't it matter more like what the writing to the register file delay is?
So the assumption is that we have our rising edge of the clock. We want to measure this cycle time. And there's multiple ways of viewing this. So if all our registers are the same, we have the part of the register delay that's at the beginning, that like small number of picoseconds, and the part that's at before we write. And they might be around the same order, but we're paying for the sum of those either way. So if they're the same for our PC versus in this, like I can draw, like I have the PC out and array in. Okay, that makes sense? And I would get the same amount of time if I did, so if we assume all the registers are the same, I would get the same amount of time if I did that versus I say array out if I include it like that, because that's the same as the cycle time. So I can count for it either way if the register delays are the same. If they were different, things get a lot more complicated, and you would need to know about what are the components of the register delay. In this class, we generally won't be talking about that. So we'll just talk about a single register delay that's the same for all of them, just to keep things simpler, because we haven't really talked about this level of detail about how registers work. Yes?
What would make two registers have a different delay?
The question is, what would make two registers have a different delay? There are different ways of building registers.
But so we wouldn't
There are different register designs, and conceptually you could use different ones in the same processor. I don't know if it would ever make sense to do so, but that is a possible thing. Okay. And other questions? So I think I'll leave up here. So we have an exam next week. I will be doing exam review next Tuesday. If you want me to answer questions, it would help you to help if you had questions, because I am not going to prepare something otherwise. And that's all I have.
I was looking at the slides earlier. 2 minutes.